The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, talking all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. I'm your host, Aida Leisenring, and with me today, as always, every Monday night, Bruce Barquette.
Good evening, Aida. How are you tonight?
I'm very well, and I'm really, really excited because we have this fantastic guest tonight. We're so lucky to have one of our guests is Amanda Knox, famous exoneree who spent 4 years imprisoned in Italy for the wrongful conviction of the murder of her roommate, Meredith Kircher. She's also a New York Times bestselling author, a journalist, and a co-host of the podcast Labyrinths. She's going to talk to us tonight about how false confessions can happen to anyone, not just someone with a low IQ, not just someone that's being beaten in Guantanamo Bay, but an educated person like you and me. And she's also going to talk about the other victims to wrongful convictions, family members of those who are struggling alongside and supporting you.
Fascinating. Can't wait to speak with her. She'll be spectacular. So what happened to our socialite from last week?
Right. So those who didn't tune in Monday, we talked about, speaking of people charged abroad, Jasmine Harden, who's married to Lord Ashcroft's son, multi-billionaire, got charged and arrested and detained without bail on the murder of the police chief in Belize. And she actually had her bail hearing just after. And, you know, you would think typically on manslaughter charges, the bail would be very significant, especially with millionaire, billionaire wives. But it actually, I think, was something like $5,000 to $10,000. So she's out and the mystery will keep unfolding and we'll hopefully find out what really happened.
It was an interesting case. It will, as we chatted about last week, I'm not sure it all added up the way she described it, but we'll see. The accidental shooting and killing of a police chief with his own gun on a dock at 3 a.m. after they both were drinking, supposedly her reloading and unloading and reloading a gun and then not being able to get the magazine out.
Her defense is going to be sitting on the dock of the bay.
You're going to sing for us tonight. Excellent.
Watching, yeah.
So also we have privacy rights of citizens and journalists. And actually this is something close to my heart, and I know it's something close to your heart.
Very, especially because nowadays normal citizens without criminal records, you know, often there's a stereotype that a drug dealer gets arrested and he's got 3 phones, 12 encryption programs, a beeper. But nowadays, business people, individuals without criminal records, individuals not intending to commit crimes are downloading apps like MeWe, Signal, Wicker, Wire, WhatsApp, and Why, because we want privacy. We don't want the government to know our thoughts. And our phones are really our diaries, and they're still shots of our thoughts and our insight.
It really, you have to stop for a second. If you go back just 30 years ago, for the government to get into your thoughts, they had to tap your phone or bug your apartment or your place of business. Now, everything that you do, from banking to dating to socializing to chatting with relatives and friends and girlfriends and spouses and so forth, comes through your phone. So if the government gets access to your phone, they get access to your entire life, everything.
And they can also get access to all your internet searches, as embarrassing as they may be. And we know this on just kind of a day-to-day basis. You don't have to be the kingpin of a Mexican cartel for, I don't know why I said cartel that way, for a Mexican cartel for the federal government to apply for a search warrant for your phone and literally do a forensics like colonoscopy to see everything that's in it. You can be charged. I've seen this with something as minor as a DWI. I don't mean to minimize DWIs, but you know, somebody got into a car accident. I've seen prosecutors applying for and getting search warrants to read through the text messages of that individual to see what they were doing before. So it's for me, it's kind of an upsetting thing, because when I started my career, we didn't have all of this discovery that the government gets access to and then has to turn over to you. And it's never embarrassing for me because I take my job seriously, but I realize how awkward it can be for a client to know that I'm seeing everything on his phone that may not be relevant and usually isn't relevant to the case. But this is sick. Explain to listeners what the government has done. I think this is
well, one of the ways that the citizens have reacted to this intrusion into their lives, our lives, is to get encrypted apps that allow them to communicate with people and not have the government have access to it. So what the FBI did, being the smart or devious little devils they can be, they invented their own app. And they went out. It's called Anon.
Actually, they took down a company that provided encryption services after discovering that it was selling its devices to criminal organizations. Then they flipped one of those guys and got him to give him access to the encrypted service. And they created phones with Anon, which is the program. And then they had the informant distribute it out into the market.
And they so people across the globe were purchasing cell phones with this Anon app on it, thinking that they were super encrypted. And what the app actually did is copied every single message that was sent and gave it to law enforcement across the world.
So they could read in real time what you were saying, who you were saying it to, et cetera.
And of course, they justified this and with the arrest of 800 people across the globe, seizure of 8 tons of cocaine, 22 tons of marijuana, 2 tons of synthetic drugs, 250 firearms, and according to them, 150 threats to human life were also disrupted, their word.
And just to not do everything in a light most favorable to the criminal defense lawyer in me, what the government claims is that the informant distributed it to his contacts in criminal organizations, and that because of his reputation and their reputation, they were able to redistribute thousands and thousands and thousands of phone. So they admit that the operation spread to over 300 criminal organizations with operations in 100 different countries, and that the user sent over 20 million messages from nearly 12,000 devices detailing illegal activity. But, okay, so a lot of people go, oh, well, who cares? They're just distributing it amongst criminals. But they've arrested 800 people, but yet there's over 12,000 devices. So imagine, like, a friend of a friend, I'd love an encrypted phone, or if you're, dissident living in an authoritarian country that doesn't want your messages reviewed. They did have governments reviewing their personal and private text messages. They just don't know it.
But that goes back to the age-old argument that if you don't have anything to hide, then why do you care if the government looks at it? So, just search my house, search the house of my neighbor, search everybody's house. You don't need a warrant. You don't need to do anything because you have nothing to hide. There should be no problem. That is just counter to our Constitution, obviously, and counter to American culture, thankfully, that we are entitled to privacy, that we don't want people coming into our houses, we don't want people looking at our phones, knowing what we're saying, what we're talking about, without some probable cause finding that we're engaged in illegal activity.
But you realize they got around this, and if you look at their website, they're very proud, the San Diego U.S. Attorney's Office, they got around this by having Australia and other countries actually review the text messages.
I'm not so sure that gets them around the expectation of privacy of United States citizens who may have been abroad communicating. Hiring an agent to do something you know is illegal is still illegal. But regardless of whether or not they get around the constitutional prohibitions, I don't think it's a good idea for the government to be passing out cell phones and reviewing messages of thousands of people, regardless of whether or not some of those people may be committing crimes. You simply think about what's happening here. You have government and governments, and your point about the fact that you could have dissidents not wanting their
journalists like to use encrypted messages.
Right, and you can't have the government reviewing all those at their leisure. And the fact that it's some, you know, walled off firewall team that sees them, I don't care. I don't want anybody to review the messages on my phone except for the people that they're intended to.
Especially when I'm traveling through Europe.
Yeah.
But here's my kind of favorite thing. They brag about it on their website. And I get that. They're proud. It was a successful operation. It's called Operation Trojan Horse. Is that when you actually look at the numbers, they say today with the unsealing of a federal grand jury indictment in San Diego, which I always want to say San Diego, charging 17 foreign nationals with distributing thousands of encrypted communication devices to criminal syndicates, and they only actually arrested 8 of them. So after all this money has been spent, after all these resources were set forth for high-tech, you know, organization of this entire operation that was worldwide, what does the U.S. Attorney's Office have to show for it? 8 foreign nationals. And the tons of marijuana that were recovered were outside the country, and I think 250 firearms. Well, that's good. We'd like to get guns off the street, but those guns aren't in America. And from what I understand, I don't know, I don't think they were coming into America. And America is actually the only country that has the most severe gun problem. So I don't like this. I think it's really scary that the government is doing this.
This is a theme that we're going to come back to again and again, which are privacy interests contrasted with the need for law enforcement and how we balance the two. And I'm afraid the privacy interest has been losing out lately.
I'm going to start using cups. What do you call those cups with like strings to communicate with people? Or actually pigeons. I'm going to start sending pigeon messages to my friends.
So let's take a break for a moment and thank our sponsor, which is
Barquette, Epstein, Kieran, Aldea, and Laterco.
Our law firm that's good enough to allow us to come here once a week and chat about crime and justice. We are a litigation firm that handles all sorts of litigation from appellate practice to straightforward DWIs to the most complex federal litigation. Very proud of our firm. I really could spend the whole hour bragging about it. I won't. But if you want to... good, solid representation at any level of litigation, you should definitely consult Barquette, Epstein, Kieran, Aldea, and Laterco. You can find this at www.barquetteepstein.com at 516-745-1500.
And you don't have to brag. The website brags for us.
it does indeed.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
It does indeed. Let's move to another version of privacy interest being invaded, which is the Trump Justice Department secretly subpoenaed records of 2 House Democrats and a number of people in the press trying to get their cell phone metadata, emails, and call logs, not only for them, but for their families. So, and this was something that was done under Department of Justice regulations. It's been done with various administrations going back to the Bush administration. And it's, again, very troubling. You're a journalist or a congressman. And the next thing you know, your email messages are being seized by the Department of Justice in a secret proceeding where the lawyers for your company aren't allowed to tell you what's going on.
And just to be clear, when I first read metadata, and I should know this better, I assumed that meant that they were actually reading the content of the text messages and the emails themselves. But what they asked for was really subscriber information. And metadata is actually the incoming, outcoming call information on who was called, who you received a call from, and the amount of time that the call lasted, and text, of course.
They were looking for the contents of the emails as well. They just never got them.
True. But that's been a forever thing. I didn't realize Apple puts up such a fight. Thank you, Apple, for doing that.
Right, right.
And like you said, it's every single administration. We often say, you know, the Obama administration or the Trump administration. Obama, too, was accused of this. Apparently, he secretly looked through, not he personally, but his Justice Department, phone records of nearly 100 Associated Press reporters. And he's alleged to have prosecuted 3 times as many cases targeting whistleblowers. and leakers. But it is scary that we have a Justice Department, no matter who is president, that has the power and ability to get subpoenas in a secret federal grand jury proceeding without an actual matter being present just to investigate.
There weren't just grand juries. They went to a court and got, there's regulations in place. Grand juries, of course, they can subpoena phone records. But they went to a court to begin an investigation by pulling the records of Congress people and of members of the press without any grand jury impaneled,
and
without any investigation.
And that's the headline. And however, I'm not sure it was ultimately two Democratic senators, Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, and I'm not sure they were initially targeted. I think what they looked for was approximately 73 phone numbers, 36 email addresses. Like I said, not the content, ultimately resulted in no arrest. And what makes me believe that they weren't initially targeted was Barr and Sessions claimed to be completely unaware of these subpoenas. And so because they were at the time, if you recall, Reality Winner, who was the NSA employee, the young woman who was the whistleblower.
Tell us, I don't recall hardly,
right.
so tell us what that's about.
She gave classified documents regarding the Russian interference in the election or the investigation thereof from NSA to Intercept. And I'm not sure, there's allegations by Julian Assange that Intercept actually sold her out, but that was an investigation taking place in 2017, 2018, and they too went through her computers, found out, you know, all the different computers of all the different employees who had actually communicated with the press, and that's how you get other numbers that lead to other numbers. She ended up getting sentenced to 5 years, and she's just recently been released.
Wow. Wow. Hey, I want to come back to the death penalty, which is another theme that we'll touch on from time to time. And I'm going to ask an odd question maybe. Did you ever play the game or sitting around drinking one night and somebody says to you, what would be the worst way to die? Do you want to get burned to death? Do you want to get drowned? Would you rather get electrocuted? Do
you
want to get
shot? You had an unfortunate childhood, Bruce.
People have asked this kind of question over and over and over again. What's the worst way to die? If you got to pick your way to die, what would you be? What would it be? Well, guess what? The state of South Carolina is playing that game for real. There are individuals on death row in South Carolina, and South Carolina can't get the drugs to provide or to administer a lethal injection. So what they have done is they've enacted a law, these crazy people, and they've enacted a law that says you, inmate, sentenced to death, have to pick either electrocution or a firing squad. And if you don't pick, we're going to electrocute you. And this Friday, they are scheduling to execute by electrocution an individual by the name of Brad Sigmund for the murder of his ex-girlfriend's parents back in 2002 is when he was convicted. He's supposed to be executed this Friday, June 18th.
But hold on, Bruce. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. Sorry.
But
I went off a little bit.
Yeah, you were talking for too long. But you're saying he has a choice. And here's the crazy part. He actually doesn't have a choice because they haven't figured out how to do the firing squad yet.
Well, then if I was him, I'd pick the firing squad.
Exactly. I mean, it's obviously not funny. And by the way, the chair, the electric chair that they use is 109 years old.
It's just
fun, creepy, psychotic fact.
That is truly unbelievable if you stop and think about it for a second.
And his lawyers argue that this was obviously a violation of the Eighth Amendment. It's cruel and unusual punishment. And we heard from executioner Ron McAndrews, who deeply regrets his participation in executions and is now an abolitionist. And when he describes the electric chair, you really wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. And he actually presided over a botched electric chair. And he told us about all the different tools they use to sanitize it so that the press and witnesses don't see how truly painful and truly ugly and messy it can get.
Well, I don't want to repeat what we've said on previous shows, but if you want to hear his account, you should go back to our third episode, Ron McAndrew, and he'll describe... And he described a scene right out of The Green Mile. They didn't have enough water on the person's head in the sponge, and it lit the individual on fire in an electric chair. which is one of the reasons why they stopped using the electric chair, at least in most of these states. But apparently South Carolina thinks it's perfectly okay. And if you don't like that, well, you can be shot by a firing squad.
And a federal judge last Friday, based on the attorney for Sigmund's argument, said he declined to stop the upcoming execution, saying that they hadn't established it was cruel and unusual punishment because it's been used in the past.
Well, so has the rack. So is hung, drawn, and quartered. Hanging. There's a number of ways that governments have killed people.
Right. And by the way, I Googled right before. That's what I was snickering at. What is the least painful way to die? And I got all these hotlines, and I'm probably going to get a lot of email messages from suicide hotlines. And then I said, what is the least painful way to be executed? Beheading by a sharp and swift blade is the least painful method of execution, according to Cora. And that's the guillotine.
Be back in just a few minutes with Amanda Knox.
Amanda Knox, American exoneree who spent 4 years behind bars in Italy for a crime she didn't commit. We are so lucky. Oh, we're cut. Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm Aida Leisenring. I'm here with Bruce Barquette. And we are so honored to have a famed American woman who spent almost 4 years in an Italian prison following her wrongful conviction for the 2007 murder of Meredith Kircher, a fellow exchange student who shared her apartment. You know her as Amanda Knox. She was a college student at the time doing an exchange program in Perugia, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing incorrectly, and all eyes across the globe were on her. The media portrayed her terribly. She had no motive, nothing connected her to the crime, and she was convicted through a combination of coerced admissions, faulty DNA results, and character assassination. Her conviction was eventually overturned, and then she got convicted again, and it was finally overturned permanently. Amanda Knox is also, you know, we can't just define her by this moment. She's author of New York Times bestselling memoir, Waiting to be Heard. She's a journalist. She's an advocate for innocence cases and prison reform. She's a regular contributor to crimestory.com, which you have to check out. It's amazing. And she's a producer and co-host of amazing podcast, Labyrinths. Amanda, sorry for the long intro, but you deserve it. How are you doing?
Oh, well, thank you. And it's pronounced Perugia, but...
Perugia. I should know. I'm actually Spanish, but my Spanish pronunciation did not take effect there.
Thank you for having me.
So we want to get right to what I think is one of the most quintessential issues in your case was, and I don't want to call it a false confession because it wasn't a total, utter confession of any sorts, but it certainly implicated you, and it was provably false. And it was done under, I think, coercive tactics. And mm-hmm. A lot of people don't believe, even judges and smart, educated lawyers still don't really get how a false confession can occur. But it happened to you.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, again, one of the things that stays with me is I never thought about this kind of stuff, and I never believed that this kind of stuff was a big issue until it happened to me. And I blamed myself for a long time for what was happening because I couldn't imagine that the authorities would abuse my trust and manipulate and coerce me the way that they did. But the truth is that, you know, one in four wrongful convictions involve some kind of false admission, false statement, false confession that has been forced from a person through a course of interrogation techniques. And it is counterintuitive to think that like an innocent person could say anything that could implicate themselves. But the truth of the matter is, you know, when you're sitting there across from authority figures who you trust, who after experiencing something incredibly traumatic, you are in a vulnerable state of mind. And I was a 20-year-old kid with no experience with the criminal justice system. I was in a foreign country speaking a language that I was not fluent in. And I was convinced over the course of many, 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 many hours after being yelled at and hit and that I must have witnessed something and forgotten about it because I was so traumatized. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people portray this as like a false confession, but really it's more like a false witness statement.
Right.
Where I was told, hey, you witnessed something and it was so traumatic that you don't even remember it, but you have to sign this piece of paper or you'll never see your family again. And that was the position that I found myself in. And what's incredible is even the Italian courts found that that interrogation was illegal, that my rights were violated, and that it could not be submitted as evidence in court. But the mere fact that it was a known thing that happened made people suspect that I was somehow involved, somehow guilty in some way, and it was incredibly prejudicial at trial.
Well, let's back up for just 1 second and tell people who may not recall or maybe even didn't know, what happened? Your roommate was murdered, and what took place from your perspective?
Yeah, so on the night of November 1st, 2007, I was spending the night over at my brand new boyfriend's house. Like, I had known him for 5 days. I was spending the night at his house. My two Italian roommates were away, one with her boyfriend, another was away in Rome for, I think, a work thing. And Meredith was home alone. It just happened to be that she was hanging out with her friends that night, came home just as normal, and either the person who committed this crime was already there or he came after she came home. But we know that a local burglar named Rudy Gaday broke into our home and raped and murdered her.
And we know that because the DNA evidence of the rape kit and all over her room pointed to him.
Absolutely. All of the DNA evidence on her body in the crime scene all pointed to him. He had a history of breaking and entering, of wielding a knife. This was the final ultimate culmination of a long string of break-ins that he had been doing. And he targeted our home because he knew the people who lived downstairs from us. I think he probably was able to guess that no one was going to be home that night. And so he thought he could break in and steal, and then took advantage of Meredith when she was there.
So why were you accused? Where did you come into the picture?
Well, me and my boyfriend were the first people to come home and discover the crime scene. We were the ones who called the cops. And so I guess, you know, we were the first people to alert the police that something was wrong. And then because the international media descended upon this case immediately, there were television cameras sprawled around the house, like within an hour of the discovery of the crime scene. The small local police officers were under a ton of pressure to come up with answers fast, and they wanted to arrest someone immediately before they had any kind of evidence. And what they said was they had an investigative intuition that somehow I knew something and I wasn't telling them, that I somehow was involved. And so they pushed me to the brink of insanity until I was willing to sign anything they put in front of me.
Unbelievable.
And how, tell us about, it seems like they questioned you and then they brought you back in for more questioning. And this took place over the course of days. But then you were arrested and you were remanded in an Italian prison. And I assume you'd never spent, you know, a day in prison in your whole life, let alone an Italian prison.
No.
And that's where you were for nearly the next 4 years. What, how shocking was that? And, you know, was there a point where at first it's just shocking and you think, okay, it's going to get better, this is going to get cleared up, and then it sinks in that you're there?
I mean, I had lots of those moments. So when they first arrested me, they actually didn't tell me that I was a suspect and that I was being arrested for any kind of charge. What they told me was that I was a witness and that I was being taken to a holding place for my own protection. It wasn't until 3 days later, after I had been imprisoned, that I was brought before a judge and formally told, you are a suspect in this murder. So I've had multiple moments of like realizing the gravity of the situation. And, you know, even in the very beginning, for months of my imprisonment while the investigation was going on and I was held in isolation for 8 months, I was certain that the investigation would lead them to the actual perpetrator and that it was all a horrible, terrible misunderstanding and mistake and that I would be released. What I didn't count on was how much the investigators had invested themselves in me being guilty no matter what, and that their entire investigation was not designed to uncover the truth. It was designed to try to find a way to make me look guilty. And I spent, you know, the first year in prison waiting for those results to come back and waiting for, you know, this all to be cleared up. And then when they pursued a case against me anyway, even though there was no evidence, I spent the entire time that I was on trial, a whole other year, thinking, well, of course, a judge and a jury is going to see through this. And I really, really did not know until the verdict was handed down to me how much the narrative of a evil, psychopathic femme fatale was so compelling to people that it trumped the truth. I honestly had a tremendous existential crisis in that moment. I couldn't believe it was happening. And so that all to say that there were, throughout the entire process, I kept thinking, this can't be happening. The truth matters, doesn't it? And I kept having to have that door closed in my face over and over again and realize that, well, no, the truth sometimes doesn't matter. And you have to fight for it despite everything.
When you knew that there was a verdict, I assume like in the States, they say there's a verdict and your client is sitting next to you and you're awaiting the verdict. At that point, did you know how it was going to go? Did you still think that you were going to prevail and the truth matters? Or did you have a feeling that it wasn't going well?
You know, up until the moment that I heard them say culpable, guilty, I didn't think that it was possible. And, you know, my entire family had come to Italy to sit there in the courtroom and hear the verdict, even though they didn't understand a word of Italian. And they were there to take me home. They were there because they were convinced that the truth mattered. And when we heard them pronounce culpable, guilty, my world crashed around me, and it was the next visitation that I had in my family was one of the most devastating experiences of my life. We didn't even know what to say to each other, because at that point, what do you put your hope into if not the truth?
Well, how do you keep fighting? I mean, I hear what you're saying about how you trusted the system. You trusted the investigators when they brought you in, and they clearly abused that trust. And then you trusted the court system, and they abused it all the way through the process. And then you get convicted. What do you do next? What's the next thing that you trust in, or how do you move forward thinking that what you do will matter?
So I think the thing that we all had to settle into was the fact that in the justice system, there are no guarantees that justice is actually going to happen. That doesn't mean that it's not worth fighting and trying, though. And we really didn't have a choice. It was the only thing that we could do. You know, there was no giving up until there was absolutely no way to fight. So at that point, it became, we're going to fight this no matter what. But we did have the stunning realization that just because I'm innocent, it doesn't mean that that necessarily means that I'm going to receive justice at the end of this.
And Amanda, I want to back up a little, because you said that night was the most devastating moment you had with your family. I don't know if it was that night or the next time they were able to visit you. I'm curious, because you had been awaiting trial and you'd met other inmates jail officers that worked there. How were you treated mm-hmm. when you came back? I mean, was there empathy? Were people kind to you? Were you placed in solitary confinement for your own protection? Like, what was that evening like for you?
That evening, I remember the guards gave me warm milk like I was a baby. And they kept me. They didn't take me immediately back to my cell. They had me just sort of sit there with them while I processed the impossible. I was put on suicide watch, but not because I had expressed any suicidal ideology necessarily, just because it was protocol. I think they tried to make me feel as comfortable as I could from the situation. For days afterward, people were, you know, I couldn't walk down the hallway without people whispering. And, you know, I'd overhear them saying, like, she doesn't even know what happened to her. Because I was stunned. I was speechless, and I spent days and days not knowing what to think and what to do.
So tell us, I want to ask about the fact that you were a young, attractive American woman, and ask how that played itself out from in the course of this case.
Right. Well, as we all know, the criminal justice system is largely a system made by men for men, because the vast majority of crimes are committed by men. The vast majority of victims are men. And in a case like mine, where I was, first of all, a young, beautiful, promising woman was brutally, brutally raped and murdered in her own home, that already is a story that tends to call to attention. People stand up and when something like that happens. But then for a woman to be accused of committing that crime, it is so salacious that it is almost impossible to not look at. It's a train wreck, and it is something that speaks to people's fears and fantasies, and I became this blank slate onto which people could project literally their fears and fantasies. I was just the girl next door who you suddenly could have all of these horrible thoughts about, and I think that people were drawn to the salaciousness of it.
So sorry, you said before, obviously, I think the police investigation and the prosecutor's investigation was at some points just absolutely absurd and ridiculous. Like, the prosecutor said she was covered by a blanket when we found her body. So obviously a woman did this. A man would never do that. So there was all sorts of ridiculous, you know, alleged circumstantial evidence that I would hope would never hold up in America, but we see it all the time. But the British tabloids and the European tabloids just assassinated you. And to this day, when you mention your name, people will go, oh, didn't she do cartwheels? I mean, my friend's mom today was like, oh, I think what really did her in was the cartwheels. And I was like, I don't even think she did cartwheels.
I didn't even do cartwheels. Yeah, I mean, it's funny how it's always pitched that way, right? Like, oh, what did her in is this thing that she did,
right?
This thing that they did, which is the people who actually had agency in this equation, the people who could charge me with something. Like, I think the greatest tragedy of this entire case is that it's been talked about as if I'm the one, and like my actions and my behavior was what really mattered. And what is actually true is that I could have been a professional dominatrix and it shouldn't have mattered because the evidence wasn't there. And instead, investigators and prosecutors made a case based on nothing, and they pursued that case in spite of the evidence. And that is what happened. So really what did me in is has nothing to do with me at all.
It's an unbelievable story. People should definitely get a copy of your book, listen to your podcast, and tell me or tell us what you're doing now compared to what you thought you'd be doing if this didn't happen to you.
You know, I've always sort of imagined myself as a bridge builder. I went to school to be a translator, and I wanted to translate different cultures and different languages so that people could understand each other. And what I've discovered is I'm doing that today, but in an entirely different capacity. I'm trying to be the bridge builder between those who never thought they'd ever have to think about the criminal justice system and those who have no choice but to think about it. And I was the kind of person who, like I said, grew up in the suburbs, had a, you know, happy childhood, no problems, never a thought for the criminal justice system. That's what bad people have to deal with. And I realized that, no, actually, we are all vulnerable to crime and the criminal justice system. I was a victim of a crime and then a victim of the criminal justice system. And we are all invested in it. We all have a stake in it. And what we do and what we believe about the people who are experiencing the criminal justice system has an impact. So if anything, I feel like I've become a translator of the criminal justice system for the layperson, and I attempt to do that in my journalism.
It's amazing, and people want to listen to you, and I listened to the bonus episode of Labyrinths, which is your podcast, which I guess people can get easily. They can Google it or go on the Apple Podcast app. It's
yeah,
fantastic. And we're running out of time. We're 45 seconds in. We wish we
45
could talk
seconds
to you.
Left.
We wish we could talk to you for hours, but Amanda, thank you so much for speaking to us. Okay. And I wish you the best. You have so many decades left to keep doing what you're doing and more.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you are doing. I have so much respect for the show and also for all of your work to help those who are incarcerated.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
I just could have sat there and listened to her speak for another hour. That's it for Crime and Justice for this week. We'll continue to follow the case of Brad Sigmund and see what happens to him this Friday. See you next week.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.